Hey everybody, welcome back to Historians to the Movies podcast. I'm your host and creator, Jason Herbert, and every single week we are bringing you discussions about history and film and everything else in between. And I think a lot of you know, if you've been listening to the pod for a while, that I have a real affinity, a real love, if you will, for Cuban history, Cuban-American history. It's always kind of been a passion project is kind of not the right word, but just something I've always been deeply interested in. And I think maybe that just comes from my time living in Florida, my friends who have ancestry and relationships dating back to Cuba. And it's just something I've always been drawn to, I've loved, and wanted to have another podcast where I got to talk about Cuban American history. So a few years ago, I'd actually read a book by Christina Abreu called Rhythms of Race, Cuban Musicians and the Making of Latino New York City and Miami, 1940 to 1960. Just absolutely loved the book. And I'd been looking for a reason, a way to get this on. And I remember there was a film in the early 90s called The Mambo Kings with Armando Sante and very young and not English-speaking Antonio Banderas. I thought this would be a really cool entryway for us to talk about a pre-revolutionary Cuban America. So I asked Christina if she would come on. She did. And we have the best discussion for you guys today, talking a lot, not only about the roots and sounds of Cuban music and what that influences, but talking about maybe the Cuban American diaspora, talking about places, not only about Miami or New York or Ybor City, but other cities that you'll hear about during the pod where Cubans are moving to, establishing their homes, and then relating to other Spanish-speaking communities like Puerto Rican communities, Dominican communities, and so forth, and how they are confronting and overcoming the obstacles that come with moving to a new country entails, especially when that new country is going through its own growing pains in the 1940s and 50s and 60s. We're going to talk about icons in the Cuban music scene. We're talking about Celia Cruz. We're talking about Tito Puente. We're talking about all these other folks. We're talking about this film. It's such a great conversation. I really enjoyed being able to sit down and talk to Christina today. I hope that you will too. I had a blast talking to her. So sit back and relax, because The Mambo Kings is next on Historians of the Movies podcast. Christina Abreu, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm excited. We were just talking. This is our first conversation we've like had. We've like been Twitter mutuals for a decade, some jazz. So, I was super excited because I love your book. I actually have it. I bought it like years ago. It's right here. And I was thinking about it. And I was looking at it, a couple months ago. And first of all, I love the book, but the artwork on the book is just gorgeous. I mean, it's just USC Press has the best artwork, and they are unmatched. But I was looking and going, God, man, I really want to get Christina on the pod because I think the book is so cool. And, you know, you and I were just talking, like, you know, people are like still coming back to it. The book comes out in 15 and you're still doing talks on this thing. And I think it's this really amazing time right now to be talking about Cuban American history. There's so much great stuff out there right now, and your book is absolutely in conversation with this. And I was like, Mambo Kings is our ticket, and I hadn't seen this movie in like ages.
Yeah, I know. When you asked me about Mambo Kings, I was like, I don't think I've ever seen it. Then I watched it, and I was like, oh, I've totally seen this movie. And I was like, oh, this is actually like, I enjoyed watching it again after not having seen it for quite some time. So it was a fun rewatch.
Yeah, you know, it's a movie that I watched like years and years ago. And it's kind of always kind of stayed in the back of my head because we have a super young Antonio Banderas who's like, who can't speak English. Like his entire lines are all phonetic. Armando Sante is Irish Italian. He can't speak Spanish. So if you notice in that movie, like, he doesn't speak a lot of Spanish in the film, and I think that's by design, because all the Spanish he's speaking phonetically as well.
So I think this was Antonio Banderas, I think it was his first English language movie, if I'm not mistaken. And it was funny because while I was watching the movie, I kept saying, was Andy Garcia booked? Like, was he not available for why is he not in this movie? Because to me, I kept saying like he would have been such a good, you know, Armand's role, like that big brother kind of overbearing mm-hmm. kind of type. And really the early 90s is kind of when he starts taking on bigger roles. So I was it was interesting casting, I thought, with some of the language and the accents. And then we see Desi Arnaz Jr. does not speak Spanish, right? Right. So he's got the accent thing. So it's you know, we could have a whole conversation about, you know, Latino, Latinx representation in film, right? And why we don't have a lot of, right, still, right? Like, there's not a ton of
Latino. I do want to have that conversation. Yeah. Andy Garcia's Cuban, right? Garcia's Cuban?
He sure is. Yep.
Yeah. Why wouldn't you cast him in this role? In one of the roles? Yeah. And he's so talented.
I Googled it. Like, I did a little bit of a trail, just kind of figuring, like, trying to see if there was anything, if anybody had written anything about it, if there were any, like, you know, Vanity Fair or something. And there just wasn't really anything, any crumbs that I could figure out. So I don't know. I guess we need a Hollywood insider to give us the scoop on the casting decisions.
You know, it's interesting because this film comes out about the same time, I think, as like Godfather 3, right? They're not too far removed in time. You've got an Italian in DeSante playing a Cuban in this film, and you've got a Cuban in Garcia playing an Italian, an Italian American in the Godfather. It's like, okay, whatever. Are Italians and Cubans interchangeable? Is that what Hollywood is telling us? I don't know.
Yeah, that, you know, I think there's a question there about, you know, well, they're either telling us they're interchangeable or we all have a kind of mob background, right? Which could also be the indirect message. There's we're all mafiosos somehow, which is, you know, either way, they're not great messages, right? To be sending audiences.
You know what? I've dated Cuban women. I've met Cuban families, and I'm not gonna argue with that, because I remember like, oh, I need to carry myself a certain way here because I want to escape this meeting. So, all right. I got so many questions to ask for you. And I've known you for a little while. But before we jump into that, why don't we introduce yourself to the pod, to the listeners here, and then we'll jump into the film and your work.
Sure. So I'm Cristina Abreu. I'm currently an associate professor of history at Northern Illinois University. And kind of my main gig at NIU right now is I'm the director of the Center for Latino and Latin American Studies. So I direct this center. We have a minor. We have a grad certificate. We have our big kind of claim to fame is we run an oral history project. So we have a really substantive oral history project that we're working on digitizing. And so that's kind of what I do administratively. I'm working on my second book right now. So I'm working on a book on an Afro-Cuban boxer, Teofilo Stevenson, whose big claim to fame was winning 3 gold medals. He was a heavyweight, so he won 3 gold medals at the 72, 76, and 1980 Olympic Games. And he was kind of very famous for, he'd been approached many times to fight Muhammad Ali. And so his big thing was, you know, that he was an amateur and he was never going to go to the U.S. to turn pro. And the famous line is, you know, what's $1 million to the love of 1 million Cubans? And so he very much became a Cuban national hero, and just kind of, really, really ran with that sort of, you know, Cuban patriotic revolutionary, figure guy. So I'm doing kind of a cultural biography on him and, as my side hustle, right? Because my main hustle is this administrative position, so writing is sometimes takes a backseat to that.
I totally feel you. As my own writing on my own book on La Florida is, if people like Jason, just to say Florida. Don't do that. Is also taking a backseat to this beast that is now HATM. Mm-hmm. But I'm so excited to hear about this. And I want to hear about this oral history project as well. I know you conducted some oral histories for the work mm-hmm. here. This feels like a deeply personal book as I'm reading through it. I have so many questions for you. And the first question I actually have for you, usually we have this stat sheet going, but going back to my feud with Heather Richardson over Coke versus Pepsi, I don't want to ask you about this. I have to ask you because, you know, my love, what's your thoughts on Cuban coffee? Do you drink Cuban coffee or like?
I do. We have multiple little cafeteras here in my house, and so we drink Cuban coffee all the time. It's just coffee in our house. Love Cuban coffee. A little tacita de espresso in the afternoon really kind of gets you going. The story I tell folks about coffee is that I can drink it at any time of day. It has no effect on me. When I was a little kid, my grandmother used to dip our pacifiers in coffee. And we'd go to school on a mug of cafe con leche. So, I don't give my kids coffee because, that's not all the parenting books tell you don't do that. But I did it. I turned out just fine, right?
You turned into a historian, so maybe
I guess 50-50, but yeah.
A friend of mine, I got him hooked on Cuban coffee recently. He was down in Tampa. I sent him to Ybor. And he comes back, and he's starting to make Cuban coffee on his own. I teach him. I'll make it at home, and I'll send videos to him about how to make this. My buddy Chris Barr has been on the pod. So he sends me a message the other day. He was like, "Hey, it's 4 p.m. Can I have a cup of coffee?" I was like,
"How do you want the rest of the day to go?"
I was like, he's like, is it too late to have the coffee?" I was like, "Do it. I want to see what happens." Because one of my best friends, when he introduced me to it, we were down in Miami at he runs the Tamiami Orchid Festival down there.
Oh, sure.
And we are down at La Careta. For those of you listening, one of the traditional big Cuban restaurants down in Miami. And I had it at like 10 p.m. after the show, and just a little thing. And I was like, "What is this?" So I always enjoy giving, like, you're not going to sleep tonight if it's your first hit of Cuban coffee. So that's awesome. I love it. I won't drink other coffee at all.
Oh, like, really?
I'm shocked, Christina. Like, we'll talk about the Cuban diaspora today, right? But I am shocked that we don't see more colada, like, outside of, like, these pockets of Cuban culture. We see anywhere in Florida, you can probably get it. I would imagine in New York forth. And in Illinois, maybe a little bit, like Chicago or something, there's pockets there. But if I go to, like, San Francisco or some other place, like, even big cities, I can't find Cuban coffee, and it drives me, because I'm like, how are people sleeping on this? Because in the morning, I want Cuban toast. I want Cuban coffee. Like, this is my, I can't even get it in Denver. And I'm surprised by this.
Yeah. Part of me wonders if part of it is the, because it takes so much sugar, right? If that part of it is that some people don't want all that sugar, right? Because you really, if to have a good espresso, you really need to add a lot of sugar, and you got to whip it, right? So it gets that nice little froth at the top that makes it so that it's really quite thick. Yeah, it's like a thicker drinking experience. I don't know. Maybe that's a business idea. We gotta merge and trot out there, see if it'll do it in suburban. I'm in the suburbs of Chicago, so maybe.
I have the idea. Like, once we get the merchandise going for HATM, we're gonna, like, I'm putting out the little metal espumita.
Oh yeah,
little makers where I whip it up and stuff like with HATM on it or whatever. And I feel bad, right? Because in Florida, all these sugar companies, U.S. Sugar, Florida Crystals, they're the devil. I mean, they are absolutely killing the Everglades. And I'm like, I can't continue to consume this sugar. It's awful. But also, I need it. So, it's a trade-off I wrestle with. All right. I have so many questions for you. You wrote this amazing book. For you guys listening, Christina wrote this book called Rhythms of Race, Cuban Musicians and the Making of Latino, New York City and Miami, 1940 to 1960. This is such a, for me, a sweet spot. But I love this era of history. I love what you wrote here. And I want to start talking a little bit before we jump into the Cuban diaspora and things like that about what Cuban music is. You write a lot about music and these musicians and things like that. So if we can talk a little bit about what, say, makes Cuban music different than, say, other forms of Latino music or anything else, and like what defines it, what are these sounds like, and where does it come from, and maybe what does it influence?
Yeah, sure. So those are many big questions with lots of debate, really, right? So you know, the way that I kind of think about it, right, is when we're talking about origins, right, or the kind of the beginnings of Cuban music, which then many would make the argument, right, that Cuban music comes to the U.S. and it becomes this Latin music, right? That then lots of things, right, fall into that really broad category. But Cuban music really emerges, you know, in Cuba, right, 18th, 19th century, right? It's this new creation, this mixture of African rhythms, right? European sounds, European, particularly Spanish, right? Lyrics, lyricism, guitar, right? And it's this mixture, this creolization, right? This creation of a new thing in new contexts, right? So in Cuba, we see these new sounds, right? Emerging from plantations, from ethnic institutions. And so here we're talking about some of these Afro-Cuban spiritual ethnic institutions like the Abacua or even from religious traditions like Santeria, right? Where we see a lot of the traditions of drumming, right? And bata drumming, then making their way into, you know, song, right? Which is really at the core of all the different rhythms that then emerge in Havana, in New York City, and in other port cities, right? So this is really, in a lot of ways, we think about it as a Havana, New York trajectory, right? But you got to throw New Orleans in there, right? You got to throw Europe in there, right? So it's this Atlantic world kind of sound that really takes a lot of its cues and a lot of its origins from musicians and from communities in Cuba, right? So that's kind of the short version of what would be several lectures in a Latin music class.
All right, I want to jump into the film here. The film opens up, say, into 1952, and. Yeah. I think for a lot of non-Cuban Americans, like myself, who come to Cuban American history from the outside, you know, I think a lot of our understandings of Cuban American history really kind of comes post Fidel, post revolution. Sure. We think post 59, but you know, your work, Sarah McNamara's work, and others have shown, you know, there's this vibrant Cuban American tradition going on well before the revolution. So. Maybe we could talk a little bit, kind of set the stage, if you will, about why Cubans are moving into, say, New York and elsewhere, you know, in the 1950s, and where they're moving to, and how, you know, kind of mm-hmm. how they're getting there.
Yeah. So first, I do want to give a shout out to Sarah's book, Ybor City, which is great. And actually, when I first got your email about being on the pod, I was reviewing her book. So I was right in the thick of reading her book, and it's beautiful. It's a great book, and really, I think a testament to like what's really exciting about Cuban and Cuban American history right now, which is that it's really breaking down periodizations. It's really breaking down like national boundaries and really being in conversation with Latino history, with Southern history, with all these sorts of different historiographies that have kind of not even considered each other, even within the realm of possibilities of like having of stories overlapping, right? So really, really interesting. But okay, so to your question, 1950. So I think one of the things, because 1959, right, is such a moment, right? And 1959 really is I mean, it's huge because of the revolution, and then it's huge because one of the consequences, right, is these much larger, more visible waves, right? Of Cubans coming to the U.S. that from a historian's perspective, right, it ends up like overshadowing, right, what in fact was Cubans have been coming to the U.S. since always, right, just not necessarily in the same scale, right, as they did in 1959. Cubans, and this, you know, some, if you read some of like Louis Paris's work, right, on Cuba, right, he really, from him, we really get this, that understanding of the ties of singular intimacy, right? That's sort of his phrase, the ties of singular intimacy between Cuba and the United States, right? That to understand Cuba is to understand the United States. To understand the United States is to understand Cuba, right? That these are intertwined in many ways, histories. And so in the 1950s, right, Cubans had been coming to the U.S. since, you know, right, the 1900s, right? We see, for example, like late 19th century, early 20th century, you have, the U.S. was seen, right, as a place of political refuge, a place for exiles, right, to be able to kind of leave the island for a little bit so things cool down, right, back home. So like Jose Martí, right, very famous example. So why are Cubans coming to the U.S.? Well, you know, there's lots of, you know, revolutions, political unrest in Cuba throughout the Republican period, right? From independence through 1959. So there's political reasons. There's also economic reasons, right? The pursuit of job opportunities, the pursuit of you know, a better life, right? Whatever. And that's in some ways an individual decision, right? The pursuit to make it big, right? And for a lot of musicians, that's kind of what it was. It was, you know, New York is where you went to make it as a musician, right? And so going to the US, going to New York was sort of the next step if you wanted to pursue making it big. I think then within that frame, right? Like, so in the book, I talk about, for example, Mario Balsa, right? An Afro-Cuban musician who in his pursuit of making music, his decision to come to the United States was also very much motivated by his experiences being a Black man in Cuba, right? And for him, wanting to leave what he experienced as a very racist, right, island, and wanting to come to the U.S. in New York City and Harlem in particular, where he saw, right, and where he had experienced, you know, improved conditions, where he saw opportunity, where he, I think there, I can't remember the exact, quote, but it's something like, you know, I want to be where I can be a Black man, right? And I can be a Black man in Harlem, in New York City. So that's where I'm going to be, right? And so I think, you know, the motivations are multiple and various and they overlap, but I think it's part of this broader pattern of Cubans coming to the U.S. Because of the closeness of, right? And that closeness, like, I don't necessarily mean that in a good way, right? Because, you know, empire and imperialism and colonialism are not, you know, yeah. You know, I don't want to be judgy, but not necessarily great. But because
not
of that,
necessarily.
Yeah. But because of that, right. Finding, you know, there being some familiarity, right. With the U.S.
Yeah. There's this great quote that we hear in the film. I think Cesar says it, Nestor complaining about being in New York, mm-hmm. and he's like, it's the only country we got right now. Mm-hmm. This is home now. There was a very clear, because of the situations, Nestor's girlfriend Cesar nearly gets killed. They can't go back. And I'm wondering, and I'm guessing this really changes after 59, is there a sense that, you know, there's no going back to Cuba? Do you have to recreate an idea of Cuba in, say, New York or Miami or Ybor or wherever it is that Cubans are moving to? What happens with this?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think before 1959, there really is a back and forth, right? That sense of like permanence, I don't necessarily think was as prominent as it was, you know, once we hit the 1959, right? But even then, right, when Cubans start leaving Cuba in the aftermath of the revolution, like those first, you know, exiles from the early 1960s, they are not thinking that this is forever, right? They, for them, it's very much like, oh, we're going back. Cuando Fidel se caiga, right? When Fidel is gone, we're going back home. There is this sense of like, of exile being temporary, right? And then, you know, decades go by, right? And we're still here. There's, you know, in Miami, there's this, the saying, around Christmas, you know, que el próximo año, en Cuba, right? You know, we'll celebrate, you know, Nochebuena, you know, in Cuba next year. And like next year never comes, right? Next year never came, right? So I do think that even with that, right, there is this need, I think, because of daily life, right, of having to recreate home, having to recreate some community, right, that helps you get on with life. And so we see that, like, in Miami, we see that in New York in particular, with, like, the creation of, like, social clubs, right, that kind of help bring home into this new setting, right? Into this new environment, this new area that you're living in. And I think that's essential, right? For you know, migrants, you know, during this period.
Your book goes back and forth between, say, New York and Miami, obviously, you know, with these ties to Havana and elsewhere in Cuba. And I'm wondering, of course, we've talked a little bit about Ybor itself and mm-hmm. other podcasts. I'm wondering, Christina, are there other strongholds, pockets of Cubans? Are they moving elsewhere in the United States? Are there other places we need to know about?
Yeah. So somebody has got to write a book about Cubans in Chicago. Somebody's got to write a book about Cubans in L.A., there's Cubans, particularly in the 1950s, there's a Cuban nightlife in Mexico City that, I mean, Pérez Prado, for example, Mambo King, right? Like he's got a whole, like, he's super popular. He does a ton of tour. All these band leaders, they all tour in Mexico City, but Pérez Prado in particular had like a huge fan base, in Mexico City. Celia Cruz, right? She's in Mexico City for a while, right? And so I think that there are Cuban musicians and Cuban communities in these different areas. Now, more recently, like in the 2000s, tons of Cubans in Spain, right? So that's another, I actually think there might be a fairly recent book. I can't remember that's on Cubans in Spain. We'll have to Google that. Everyone Google it. The Cube. But I think there's a book on that. But I think that there are Cubans, in other areas. We just haven't gotten there yet.
You know, when I first moved to Florida in 2000, I kind of came, you know, I was selling cars, and I kind of came under the wing of like this older guy who we always kind of joke is mi padre. His name is Gil Vega. And he's from Cuba. He was born in New York City in the late 50s, and then his family actually moved back to Cuba mm-hmm. after the revolution and then left again. And then he would talk – it's so funny because he would say that, you know, as years went by, you know, the ties grew more distant. But then when he wanted to go see his friends from Cuba, he would meet them in Spain.
Sure.
You know, and he would tell me about these kinds of things. And now he tells me he's got a lot of friends from Cuba who have now retired not to the U.S. but to Spain. So mm-hmm. he goes over to meet them, and then they go do whatever. And I can imagine only the food has got to be just ridiculous. And then for me, there's a very personal tie because I learned a few years ago, and I don't know if I told you about this or not. There's apparently a very strong Cuban community in Louisville, Kentucky.
Really?
Yes. I read about this recently, a couple years ago, and they call them Kentacubanos. So next time I'm in Louisville, is about 3.5-4 hours away from my home in Western Kentucky, but I am dying. Like, I'm going to show up with my Domino's aki, and I'm ready to go. So
you have to tell me when you go, because we're not that far from, my husband and I love Louisville. We used to spend, when we were in grad school, spend a week every summer there grading AP US history exams.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And so we got to know that sort of downtown area. But I have a former grad student who's from the Louisville area. She's a high school teacher now in the Jefferson County public schools. So I'm going to text her when we're done and be like, go find me some Cubans in Louisville.
I'm going to find the article and send it to you. And I'll probably, you know what I'll do? I'll post it here on social media after we're done here a little bit later this afternoon and so forth. Cause I get a kick out of this. My friends from South Florida are like, you know, you're a hillbilly, right? You're not one of us. And I'm like, I can't help it. I feel like such a fraud, Christina. Okay. We're talking about these Cuban American communities and things like that. And, you know, we talk a little bit about the idea to find oneself maybe in the United States as a black man or things like that. Mm-hmm. But I'm kind of also wondering, when Cubans are arriving and establishing their own selves in the United States, whether it's in Miami or Ybor or New York or Chicago or else, how are they relating? Do Cubans integrate into other Spanish speaking communities that, like, you know, say of Puerto Ricans, or are these groups kind of like kind of nodes that kind of engage with one another? Like, mm-hmm. how do Cubans relate to Puerto Ricans or Venezuelans or Mexicans or? Is your research suggesting that there are ties? How do they relate to one another? I have to imagine the Spanish, the language and the culture aid in that.
Yeah. So I would say, you know, it varied and it depended on the historical moment and the particular historical context. So for example, you know, in New York, you have Cubans arriving around the same time as, you know, the 1940s and 1950s, around the same time where the Puerto Rican community is really growing at a much larger scale. And so, you know, there were times when they got along and when there was this, this sense of fraternity or this sense of community, of this sense of Latinidad, of like, we are Latinos, we are of the Spanish speaking Latin American origin community in this new space. Let's come together, right? To help one another, to demand rights, to advocate for ourselves and our communities, right? And then there were times when they just did not get along, where they were very much, we're Puerto Rican, you're Cuban, we are different, and this fraternity, this family is not it. In a lot of ways, race played a very, very particular, a very prominent or significant role in some of this, because we see plenty of examples where you know, we have lighter skinned Cubans, lighter skinned Puerto Ricans coming together, right? And advocating for, not advocating for rights as Cubans, as Puerto Ricans, but advocating for rights as whites, right? And so that leaves out, right? Puerto Ricans, Cubans of color, and we see an example of this, right, with a lot of like the social clubs and the ethnic institutions that develop, right, where you've got the clubs for the white Cubans and then you've got the clubs for the black Cubans, right? We see some of these challenges too when some of these bands, you have bands of Cubans, of Puerto Ricans, of light skinned, dark skinned, in between. They're able to play in some venues, in New York, right? And then they go down like Machito's band, and then you go down to Miami, right? And they can't stay they all can't stay at the same hotel. They are not included. You know, they don't club managers don't want them all to all performing, right? And so the racism, the segregation, really manifests itself, in different ways in different cities, but it's always ever present. And they navigated, you know, in different ways. In Miami, for example, there's the example of, Graciela and Machito, getting to stay, in a hotel because they start speaking Spanish. And so they're like, oh, no, we're not black. We're foreign, right? We're international. We're Cuban. You see kind of the same thing, like, with like baseball players, Cuban baseball players. Adrian Burgos, his book is a good example of where he really kind of talks about the racialization, right, of Cubans and Latinos of color in the U.S. also during this period.
Yeah, it's, you know, so especially like, I would imagine like Afro-Cubans, Afro-Puerto Ricans, Afro-Dominicans, whomever, right? People of African descent who are moving into the United States in this time period from the 40s to the 60s are interjecting themselves not only into another country, but also into another country that is also in the midst of its own violent rebirth. The civil rights era is a particularly nasty time in the United States. People of color have always wrestled with injustice here all the way up to 2024. And these folks are combating that as they arrive. It's maybe a land of opportunity, but still a land of tremendous obstacles, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's having to navigate, right? It's having to navigate Cubanness, right? And what that means. And then also having to navigate, right, how you're being racialized in the United States, right? In Cuba, right? It's not to say that Cuba was this racial paradise, right? Where there's no, where there was no racism or no discrimination, but it was different, right? Than the way that racism and racialization operated in the United States. And so that's what these Afro-Cubans, Afro-Puerto Ricans are having to like figure out, right? Is how to navigate race in the United States at a moment, right, where increasingly, like, it becomes dangerous, right, and it becomes problematic for these folks.
I'm wondering, you know, and I got the sense, even when we were watching the clubs in the film, right, I got a sense that the bands were more integrated than, say, the crowd. The crowd tended to be more, I don't know the right word here, Christina, like Anglo-Cuban, like fair-skinned Cuban. I don't know the right terminology here. But it felt cotton clubby to me.
You know? Yeah. And certainly some of the clubs were that way, right? Because so the thing with music too, with Latin music, right? And why in some of these very like white spaces where the audiences were mostly white, you'd have performers of color, right? Because with performers of color, right, it comes the authenticity, right? And so comes the exotic, right? Take me to the tropical island. I don't want to go to Havana, but bring Havana to me, right? And so there's an allowance, right, for blackness, right? There's an allowance for, you know, women to perhaps dress a little more provocatively or dance a little bit more provocatively, because that's what the audiences wanted to see. That's what you were paying for. That's why you were going to the club, right? And so the extent to which these things, you know, how exotic, quote unquote, you got, you know, depended on the club, right? And so in New York, it was very much this, you know, below 96th Street, above 96th Street divide, where, you know, above 96th Street, right? It was, you know, the audiences were perhaps more integrated, were perhaps more open to audiences of color. Below 96th Street is very less so, right? But in watching the film, right, they're at the Palladium, right? And that's where the scene where Nestor, you know, hops on stage and plays the drums, right, with Tito Puente and like that whole bit. You know, the Palladium is also one of these interesting nightclubs where it really has this romantic legacy of being a nightclub that was integrated and being a nightclub where everybody was just there to dance. And I recently read an article, and unfortunately I was a reader, a manuscript reader for a journal, and so I don't know who the author is, so I hope that they're listening and they can share. I don't think it hasn't been published yet, but a really great article where the author makes the point that sure, the Palladium was open to all sorts of audiences, Hollywood celebrities and, you know, Latinos of color from Harlem, right? But they make the point that they were never there on the same night, that the Palladium was segregated by night. So you would go on a Wednesday night and that was for one particular audience, Thursday another, Friday another, that there was never really this this mixture, right, of all of these different groups. And I was like, yeah, like totally, right? Like it was kind of this like aha, like yeah, that I think that's a really accurate assessment of the Palladium.
Yeah, the Palladium becomes like a different place each night, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's like mm-hmm. there are different classes, different people allowed in, different. You never. It may have built itself as like, oh yeah, of course all of these people come here, but not really, right?
They're not
sharing the same space and time. You talked a little bit about the icons of music, and we see, you know, one of the cool things I like seeing this is like I see Celia Cruz here, I see Tito Puente here. So I'm kind of wondering how Cuban music, or you know, Tito Puente is Puerto Rican, but Latino music, I guess, is kind of maybe defining music, or is it reaching beyond Latino culture, specifically Latino culture mm-hmm. in the United States during this time period? Is it influencing other things? Are people coming from outside to listen in? What's going on with these icons? Because I knew who Celia Cruz was growing up, and I grew up in Kentucky, you know?
Yeah, so Celia Cruz is one of these figures who and I've written a little bit about her, you know, so I certainly would argue that she's one of these crossover artists, right? Kind of like, you know, like we would say Shakira or, you know, Ricky Martin, Enrique Iglesias, right? These performers who start their careers, right, with, you know, singing in Spain, you know, performing for in Celia Cruz's, you know, in that example for Cuban audiences, but then really becomes sort of pan, you know, performing for pan Latino, you know, audiences, and then becomes very popular with white audiences and international audiences, and kind of, you know, has a kind of a very broad popularity. I think Celia Cruz has that, and the thing, she never sings in English. Right. And so a lot of these other crossover artists, right, they when they cross over, it's because they start singing in English. But Celia Cruz, in this film, I think one of the things that stood out to me about her in this film is that she always would prefer doing interviews in Spanish. And she would often say at her concerts and during interviews, you know, no, en español, because my English is not very good looking, right? That was her sort of shtick. And she has lines in English and she delivers them like amazingly, right? Like she's such a great, you know, I think she's a really good performer. But I, you know, I think when talking about sort of this crossover, of music, I think she's, I think she knew exactly what she was doing when she was doing it, and she was very purposeful and intentional in her choices, both in terms of music and her style and the way she carried herself. But and then just to kind of bring Tito Puente in, right? So these are performers that, my God, they have longevity, right? Like they're really popular. They are. They're popular with audiences, but they're also well respected as musicians, right? And that's not the case with everybody, right? And so they start their careers, their kind of trek into stardom in the 1950s, and it's kind of and then right, for Tito Puente and Celia, it's really in the 1960s and 1970s when they start creating, right, what's called like this, the new sound of salsa. And salsa is another one of these sort of contested musical genres that some say, oh, you know, salsa is just Cuban music, and I don't know why we're calling it salsa. It's just being marketed as salsa, but it's just Cuban music. And then other people are, you know, make the argument, well, yeah, kind of, but like because it's got the 3-2 clave, it's Cuban, but it's an entirely new sound, an entirely new creation that is the product of New York City in the late 1960s and 1970s. And actually during this period, when salsa first comes out, it's really not, it's really unique or to New York, and kind of struggles a little bit with popularity outside of the Latino community. And then late 1970s, 1980s, when there's kind of this renewed interest in things that are ethnic, right, that people are like, oh, salsa, right, we like this, right? And but it's just Celia is one of these figures that has just been so dominant and prominent across decades of like musical change. I just think she's super fascinating that way.
I want to ask you about another major figure we see in this film. Kind of the high point of this film revolves around the guys going on the I Love Lucy show. I love Lucy show. I can't talk anymore. My English is ugly. Sally Cruz's English is better than mine today. Can we talk about the importance of Desi Arnaz to Cuban Americans in the United States and maybe also Cubans in Cuba? What to Cuban America was Desi Arnaz?
Yeah. So I struggled with this writing the book. I struggled with this when I knew we were going to talk about this today a little bit. And it's, I think it is undeniable that Desi Arnaz and Ricky Ricardo, right? Cause I think sometimes these two figures, these two names, they're both the same and different. Right. And so I think that Desi and Ricky, are become very representative of Cuban America, but I don't know necessarily that it's their representative of Cuban America to Cuban Americans. I think non-Cuban Americans, when they think about, name me a Cuban American, right? It's Desi, right? It's Ricky. But I think, among Cuban Americans, cause I looked at that, I paid attention to that scene, when they're all gathered around the TV watching, I Love Lucy, and when Desi is at the nightclub, and I'm like, I don't have an answer. I don't know that Cubans would be like, oh, ese Desi Arnaz, I don't know. I think if that was Miguelito Valdez, I think that then certainly I think there might have been, more affinity, I think more appreciation of what he stood for, right? Of the sort of being, quote unquote, like a more authentic, right? Representative. But I think with Desi, I think there's probably some tension there, because I think that Desi makes it big, goes off to Hollywood, and there's not that much connection with the Cuban community. Right. In New York, in Miami, he doesn't say a whole lot, if anything at all, about politics, about the revolution, about anything going on. And so there's a distancing there, I think, that for Cubans, I don't necessarily think that he's like a beloved icon to the same extent as, Celia Cruz, Gloria Estefan, some of these other sort of, big, celebrity names that like, how don't ever say, don't utter a bad word about kind of thing.
I have one other question. There is and we've been hinting at it all day or in our conversation, there is the shadow of the revolution. We as viewers know what's coming. People who are, this is based on a stage play, we all know what's coming. We have the power of knowing what's ahead. You write about this in the book. You could carry your book all the way up to 60. And I'm kind of wondering, Christina, how is the revolution affecting Cuban Americans already in the United States? What happens next for these communities that are already established?
Yeah. So, I mean, the movie set in 1952, right? And so throughout the 1950s, there is unrest and instability on the island. There's frequent protests, strikes, urban bombings. Like, I think sometimes the mythology of the revolution is such that we think it's all Fidel and it's all 1959 and it's this sort of like thing. And it's not, right? There was very much like a peasant movement and also an urban movement that had different leaders throughout. And it's really not until like 1957, 1958, that kind of Fidel emerges as this leader of a movement that was kind of leaderless for a while, right? Or that didn't have kind of the branding, right, of a of the revolutionary leader. And so I think once the revolution comes to be, you know, the Cuban communities in the U.S., they kind of shift their focus, right? And in the sense that there's now more of them, and so the needs are greater, the needs are more. But there's also some power that comes in numbers and comes in being able to take up space, right, in a neighborhood, to take up space in a particular community that is different than before. There's also much more uncertainty about, you know, do we go back? Do we stay? Do we wait? How's this all gonna play out? And also the thing is too, that some of these Cubans from, you know, they'd already been here 20 years, right? Like they've been here since the 1940s. Now it's 1959. And so this is now home, right?
Because this that is home, that, yeah.
That, yeah. And so, there is this, you know, but then there's also like expansion of, cause we see in the 60s and the 70s, right? Like far more, like Cuban ethnic institutions, sort of this explosion of, like Spanish language newspapers, of far more elected officials, right? Of from the Cuban community, far more influence in local politics. And I mean, we need a whole other podcast, right, to talk about like Cuban Americans and politics, right? And their influence on the U.S., right, political landscape. And so I think that really changes the community.
Oh, I have a pod that I'm dying to add you and Sarah and a few other folks to.
Yeah,
I'm calling my super pod. this is a long gestation. Sarah knows about my villainous plans. I want to ask you about the film itself. Are there parts of this film, we talked a little bit about some of the things we really like to see and things like that. Rewatching this movie, are there parts of this film that you really relate to or that you found that you really enjoyed?
I guess that's a hard question. Like, did I like the movie? I mean, or you know, Yeah. I mean, yeah. Like I struggled a little bit with, you know, it's, you know, when you're watching a movie with an eye for analysis, it's like you kind of like ruin it for yourself to a certain to a certain extent. But it, you know, it was enjoyable to watch, right? Some of the, like the love story is very touching. The bolero, right, that César composes, it's beautiful, right? I thought it was kind of interesting. You know, that it's the song that makes them is a ballad. It's a love ballad. It's not a mambo. It's not a cha-cha-cha, right? It's a sort of like touching, endearing love song. So I liked, you know, so I thought that was compelling. I thought it was interesting. That many of the prominent like club owners and club, like behind the scenes, like fixers, right? In the nightclub scene were actors of color, right? And so I thought I was curious, like who is this supposed to be in real life, right? I kept asking myself, who's this guy? Like who's I thought that was interesting. I liked one of the things that I thought was really was accurate actually in the film. Was when César and Nestor first get to the club where they're trying to get some work, and one of the guys in the club tells them to join the musicians union, to go to the union, they'll help you out. Musicians union was definitely important, like played a really important role for a lot of these musicians to find work, to find other musicians that they could perform with, to get leads on club gigs. I thought that once they have the falling out with kind of the mobster-ish band leader in New York, they then kind of have to do the wedding, birthday, bat mitzvah circuit, right?
they're gonna circuit, right?
Right. That's true. Yeah, like that was a way that a lot of these bands made money, right? And because they had day jobs, right? So they're working in like a slaughterhouse, right? Like that's also, you know, yeah. I think that was very. That was a pretty solid like representation of of life for musicians, Cuban musicians in the 40s and 50s, you know, recent arrivals trying to get their life together, trying to make it big. So I thought that was pretty, pretty spot on. Multi-generational families, right, living together in the same apartment, although that was a very nice apartment. But I thought that was, you know, very, very spot on.
Are the things that drive you nuts about this movie?
Well, we talked about a little bit of the accents really got me, like why some people had accents, others didn't. Some of the accents were forced, which I thought was like why? So that was annoying, I guess. You know, and then I guess it's just, you know, it's a sad story in the end, right? Like it is kind of a bit of a tragedy. And so that's kind of right, you know, sad. But overall, I mean, it was, I think it's one to watch.
My great frustration was the lack of Spanish in this film. Like, I was just like, these guys are from Cuba. It's in New York. And I get it. It's for an English speaking crowd to watch the movie. Right. And so forth. But I was kind of surprised. We didn't hear more them kind of go back and forth in the language, mm-hmm. and things like that. And I guess, again, that's because you got a guy who doesn't speak English and another guy who doesn't speak Spanish. And the Armand Desante and Antonio Banderas, they look good together as brothers. They have the vibe, I think. But the language is a bit of a hurdle, you know? All right. I have to ask you. This is the first time we're going to do this. Your book is about music and musicians. We're talking about a movie called The Mambo Kings. And so I prepped you a little bit about this in the email, but if your book has a soundtrack, what's on it?
Yeah. Ooh, good question. So, I mean, there's going to be a lot.
Bluegrass, isn't it?
Yeah. It's all.
You go back north of Kentucky.
No. So maybe that's on the B side. On the A side, I mean, there's definitely, we got to have tunes on there from, you know, Arsenio Rodriguez. We got to have stuff on there from Machito. You know, definitely you got to have all, I would have both versions of Babalu. So give me Miguelito Valdez Babalu. Give me the Ricky Ricardo Desi Arnaz version of Babalu. Oh man, it's so hard. But certainly you got to throw in some Sonora Matancera, right? Some really early 1950s Celia Cruz, right? Before coming to the US. Probably you got to start out with a little bit of Xavier Cugat, right? Because in the US in the 1930s, 1940s, that's really kind of the official Latin sound for North American audiences. And then we got to, you know, at the end, we probably got to have some Pérez Prado, some, you know, some mambo for the Mambo Knicks on there.
What about books? What are the books for people who are really interested and wanting to learn more about Cuban history, Cuban American history? What's out there? What's exciting? What do you like?
Yeah, so tons of good stuff out there on Cuban American history. So certainly anything written by Michael Bustamante, who's at the University of Miami, and his book is the Cuban Exile Memory Wars. It's a really fantastic book, and he also has an edited volume that's terrific. You know, we talked about Sarah McNamara's book on Ybor City. It's probably the most recent work to come out, and it's fantastic. Devin Spence Benson writes a lot on, she's got a recent book on Afro-Cubans and Afro-Cuban America, which is really important work, and that I use a lot in the book I'm writing on Teofilo Stevenson. But that, I mean, you know, God, Elizabeth Schwall has great, a book on dance and revolutionary Cuba, which is great. She gave a talk for us at NIU that we did a really fun like Q&A. That was great. Trying to think. I mean, I'd say those are kind of the ones that are just, you know, off the top of my head. But now the minute that we're done, I'm going to look at my bookshelf and be really annoyed that I forgot to mention something.
We'll put a list out on the Substack whenever it comes out of the essential readings of this film. All right, last question here. The big question is: The Mambo Kings a history movie?
Oof. I don't know. How are we defining history movie? You tell me.
No, you're the professor. No say.
You know, I think if our threshold is, does this film offer a window, offer some insight into a historical moment, a historical period, and into you know, the lives of ordinary people at a particular moment, like if that's my definition, I'd say yeah, sure. If you want to learn, if you want a little bit, if you don't want to read it, if you don't want to read my book, but you
How
want a little
dare
bit
people.
A little
they do want to read your book.
If you want a little taste of what of Cuban America in the 1950s, then yeah, sure, do Mambo Kings. Ooh. And I remembered a few names I want to give you on the Cuban stuff. This is so like on the music side. If you want to read about Cuban music, you got to read Robin Moore, and you got to read Raúl Fernández. And then if you want a little bit on like the literary, like cultural study side, you got to do Antonio López, whose book is amazing. And Alexandra Vasquez, whose most recent book, it came out very recently, is all sitting at the top of my stack of books that I have to read.
I will race you to read them because yeah, yes. You know by now I absolutely love Cuban history. It is fascinating to me. I think it's beautiful, and it's one of these stories I just want to get out there. And I'm so Christina, I'm so happy that we had a chance to sit down and talk about your work, talk about this movie, talk about other stuff. This was amazing. So where can people find you if they want to learn more about your stuff and work and this oral history project that you're working on?
Yeah. So, I mean, you can Google my name, and NIU, and that's where you'll have my email. You'll get the link to the oral history project. I don't spend a ton of time these days on the X or whatever we're calling it now, right? It's kind of this like
Bless
weird,
you.
It's a weird space. and then, you know, I don't know where all the historians hang out now because Instagram is just my pictures of my kids and us at like, you know, playing in the snow, but
Blue Sky, maybe that's kind of where I like, it's calmer, but it's still,
it's not the same, right? Not the same. Yeah. Yeah,
you know what, they hang out at the cafe. That's where they hang out. That's where we should be doing our thing. We're gonna get a place called HATM Espuma, so
there you go.
Or something like that. We'll figure it out. So, all right, Christina, thank you so much for being here. This was I was so looking forward to this, and I'm just delighted to finally be able to sit down and talk to you. This was awesome.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for the time, the invitation, and thanks for doing this work because you give us history geeks. A little bit of space to share what we like to talk about in a fun, accessible, non-stuffy kind of way. And so that's really important in this day and age. So thank you.
Thank you. That means the world to me. And that's a wrap here at Historians of the Movies podcast. Thank you so very much to our guest, Christina Abreu, for sitting down and talking to me today, talking about Cuban coffee, Cuban music, Cuban people. Boy, this is such a fun conversation. Thank you so very much. Thank you, of course, to our producer, Fletcher Powell, who makes this show run. Thank you for being here, Fletcher, even though you are not at all Cuban. How dare you? And most of all, of course, thank you guys continually for continuing to come back and listen in, to share this podcast, to leave reviews on Apple and Spotify and all these other places, for sharing these podcasts with your friends, telling me what you like, what you know, what you want to see. All of this stuff, just means the world to me. And it just makes for a better pod. It makes for an amazing experience. And I absolutely love bringing this to you. So I hope you enjoyed today's podcast. We got a whole bunch of new stuff coming to you, and I can't wait for you to hear that too. So, that's it for now. Ciao for now.